Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome you to Porch Talk. This is your host, Alan, and I got Matthew Carlson here with me, and he is touring the Gulf Coast. Gulf Coast. Florida?
Alabama?
Alabama?
Yeah, Alabama.
Mississippi?
Mississippi. And let's see,
where else is it going to
go? Well, before I got to the Gulf Coast, I went all the way across the Midwest and then up through central New York and Pennsylvania, then up into New England, and then went all the way down the Atlantic.
Full-blown tour, baby.
Full-blown tour. It's a big loop. I'm out for basically 4 weeks. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, man.
Glad to have you in Columbus, Mississippi at Munson Brothers, and now we are stationed in Starkville. And first question out the gate is Matty C. Is that real?
It's a real thing, man.
That's real.
Yeah, it started out. No one called me Matty when I was a child, when I was like a little person.
Sure.
I was always just Matt or Matthew. And when I was in my first band in the mid 90s, it was this little art rock band called Third Uncle. And a couple of friends started calling me Matty. And it kind of caught on. And then I was in a band called the Pantones, and a few people started calling me Matty Pantone, and then it morphed into Matty C. And it's been Matty C for a solid 15, 20 years now.
Skin in the game,
that's right.
Tell me a little bit about growing up. Where are you from?
So I grew up in Michigan. Pretty standard Midwest suburban lifestyle, you know. Sister was 8 years younger, had two parents that stayed together.
Rarity.
Had love and support and didn't worry about the bills being paid. I had pretty much every advantage a kid could hope for. And of course, I, like any good old-fashioned American male, squandered it and graduated from high school with a 2.5.
My man. He was invested in every other walk.
I was. I was not. Academia was not my strong suit. I was not interested in playing games. I wanted to talk about ideas. I didn't want to have to prove I knew shit about them.
Right on. Just a little bit more about the come up, dude.
So
tell me a little bit about like those. So like middle. Go on.
So like the real formative shit for me was being 14, 15 years old, and like, so I was born in 72. So by the time you get to the early 80s and we have cable, like MTV's a thing where I'm living by like 83. We get it like a year late. And I start falling in love with, like, all the kind of, like, first wave bands, like Duran Duran and Adam and the Ants and that kind of shit. And then that led me to, do you remember the 120 Minutes show? You too young for that?
Tell me a little bit about it.
So 120 Minutes was this show on Sunday nights that was all like alternative. So it was all college rock and goth. And so it was everything from like The Cure and the Pixies. And then they would play like the new Elvis Costello stuff. And
okay. Love those.
Yeah.
But how were you during that time, dude?
So I was probably like 15 when I jumped into that world.
Prime time, dude.
Yeah. I mean, so like I, so 87. So like I found out about the Smiths just in time for the first Morrissey solo record. I found out about Depeche Mode right before Music for the Masses came out. I found out about REM right before, like right when Document and...
Athens, Georgia.
I will tell your listeners and you, I think REM are the greatest band that America has ever produced. That's my opinion.
I like that.
Huh? Yeah.
Okay. With that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, The Cure and all these guys that you mentioned, you're 15 years old.
Yeah.
Was music in your life before that? Had you touched an instrument?
So, I didn't actually...
What were you doing?
Well, let's go back. So, I fell in love with music at a really early age. My mom kind of got me really loving, like, songwriters. So, like, Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Donovan, Cat Stevens... John Denver was a big one in our house. That was like, those records really, like, you put the Back Home Again record on and I might as well be 8 years old at the cabin again. Like, that's just, I just feel that way about it. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff. A lot of like, sort of, kind of a lot of the stuff that I wound up doing now, which is a lot of like storytelling in songs and kind of evoking ideas and themes through telling those stories, you know? What's funny is my mom wasn't a John Prine fan, but, you know, later in life when I found John Prine and I turned her on to it, it made sense with all that other stuff that she had given me, you know, and so...
What was the first song that you showed her?
Souvenirs.
Great.
Yeah, off the second record.
You know, like, the first song that comes to my mind, I was in a band, and for whatever reason, this song had touched him. And the front man would always want to do Angel from Montgomery.
So that what was funny was my mom knew John Prine and didn't know it because she knew that song and she didn't know it was a John Prine song.
Oh, she knew also, it from somebody else.
Right. She also, I think she knew the Bonnie Raitt version. And then she also knew the John Denver version of Paradise, but she didn't know it was John Prine's song. You know, and
songwriter, if you will.
Songwriter, for sure. And
did
I can't
get the.
Go ahead.
I hate to interrupt you, but what about Justin Towns Earl? Did you ever spend any time there?
A little bit. Played. What's funny is I did a version of Harlem River Blues a few months ago with a friend at a little benefit thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a hoot. And that's a beautiful, great song. The stuff that I've heard is terrific. I need to spend more time with the guy.
Yeah, I had a dear friend of mine, James Mullis, early James from... from those of you out there listening, and he actually got to meet Justin Towns Earl just about a month or two before he passed.
Oh man!
And
that's such a loss too.
Great loss. Yeah. And it goes back to, if you want to say, Bradley from Sublime or Lane Staley from Alice in Chains. It was one of those. But this was a songwriter gone too soon. Maybe a Kurt Cobain.
Right, yeah, you know. I mean, you always hate to wax poetic about people, but I think, you know, when I heard the news about Justin Towns Earl, it made me think of Jeff Buckley.
Another one.
It felt like...
Memphis.
Yeah, and that wasn't...
He was swimming.
Yeah, and Jeff Buckley wasn't a guy that I was a huge fan of. I appreciated his talent, but I was never, like, super into that world, but I was, you know, but it still felt like a big loss when he died. He was very young. Felt like there was a ton of potential there. Very similar thing for Justin Towns Earl. Maybe there's a corollary because they both had super famous dads. I don't know. But
what do you make of the 27 Club?
That largely it's a coincidence, and that rock and roll is a game filled with a lot of self-destructive behavior.
True. And I would take that art form to any art as far as it would go out. When we think about art, I would tend to think of music and comedy. I would think about the art, the physical aspect itself, acrylic or oil paintings, things of that nature. But then you think about human expression with dance, or you can move on down the line. And this was the first question I had for you. Was, let me pull it up. is, so here's the prompt. Cover bands are for musicians that have given up on their dreams.
Oh boy. I have a lot of mixed feelings on this issue, and I love the topic. On the one hand, I completely understand the sentiment. I understand that for especially people who are musicians who are trying to write and perform original music like I am, there is a tendency to believe that if you're not doing that, you are somehow pandering. You are selling out, maybe not the right word, but compromising your art so that you can make money. And the reality is that I'm a guy who basically a year ago walked away from, you know, a real job because it was making me sick and I wanted to chase a dream, and so now I'm doing this.
Oh, we're going to get there. So,
you know, well, I don't want to go too far. But the point is, because it's related, it's that idea of, so now it's more practical than what are my beliefs, what are my philosophies. I have to put rubber to the road. And so,
okay.
And so what I tend to think is, I don't want my end goal to be being in an REM cover band. I don't want that to happen. If somebody came and presented me the opportunity to play in an REM cover band where I could make some money and spend time with my friends and have that be part of my gig schedule, I don't think there's any shame in that.
Sure. I'll tell you my response.
Please.
Is it is such a curious thing that this seems to be the only art form where you can make decent money playing other people's art. It's probably why music transcends language. It's kind of hardwired in. You just want to be where it is. It's like water, and sometimes you just want the water that you know.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. I think that's I think that's a brilliantly phrased estimation of the whole thing, Al. For me, I think a lot of it too is that
there's a part B.
Let me before we get to part B, and then I'll follow up my thought.
Stealing a joke, there's the difference. That's where the train of thought happens. You're covering a song, you're stealing a joke.
Right.
And think about this. If I were to pick up an author like a Hemingway, right, and I was trying to put out something Hemingway as if it was mine.
Right.
You couldn't. That's plagiarism.
Look at the Gus Van Sant, you know, shot for shot remake of Psycho. You know, we all saw that and went, well, that was a useless exercise. Why did he do that?
Mm-hmm.
And no one's done it since. Because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to do that. I think the reason to be in a cover band is that there are bands that people never got to see or can't see. You know, I can understand the appeal of somebody saying, I want to spend $35 to go see a really well-produced Beatles tribute band because I love those songs and I'm never going to get to see the Beatles. I don't know that there's something wrong with that experience, especially if you understand that you're getting a recreation. It's not any different than going to the museum and seeing the recreation of the thing instead of the real thing. You're still getting a sense of the thing and you're learning about the thing. But don't trick yourself into believing you're seeing the real thing. I think that's where it gets dangerous, right? That's where it gets a little sketchy. I think as far as the giving up on your dreams, I think the moment that you start doing all of your creative work for what the end result is going to be, you've given up. Because you're not doing it for you. You're doing it for somebody else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I totally agree with that. It's the it's a sentiment of that you have to first define what successful is for you as an artist. And so, like, with what I am trying to do, I consider myself a singer-songwriter. I play probably 10, 15 shows a year.
Okay.
And most of those are private.
Right.
House shows.
Yep.
But I throw music festivals, and I put together events, and I book people who wouldn't normally come to our area. And so, like, the way that I look at success, it's a little broader scope, is, like, I'm just trying to add to a scene, and I want this scene to have things that it wouldn't regularly have. And if I can facilitate that, that's what I want to do. On top of, like, what someone local can just do privately.
Well, and we touched on this when we were talking before we hit record, but like the whole thing, when we talk about the idea of a scene,
yeah,
we use that as shorthand for a community. That's the word we use as a placeholder for community, because community sounds weird. It sounds governmental or civic.
It might even sound religious.
It might even sound religious. The reality is, it's a community. It's a group of like-minded folks building a thing together, mm-hmm, with a kind of shared common goal. Maybe it's a nebulous goal or it's a series of goals, but you're all kind of building toward the same thing. You're all saying, mm-hmm, I want these things to happen in my town.
Sure.
You know, I've been having this conversation a lot on this trip. Nobody gets stoked when an accountant moves in on the corner on their block. Nobody gets jazzed up when a new funeral home comes to town or when there's a new hardware store. Nobody's like, oh, my God. But if there's a new restaurant or a bar or a brewery or a venue or a movie theater, now all of a sudden we're getting little chubbies. And that's great. But why are you doing that? Because that's the shit you want where you live.
It's water and hoe.
We all want cool shit. Here's the trick. If you get cool shit, pay for it, or it ain't going to stay.
Uh-huh.
Support it with your dollars. Don't say, wow, that's really neat, I'm glad that's here. And then when it's gone and you never went there, or you went there once and never went back, say, oh, it's a shame that didn't work. Well, it didn't work because you. It didn't work because you didn't invest in it. And if you don't, if you go to Applebee's instead of the cool new bagel place, your town's going to give you more Applebee's. So put your money and your time in places where you want it to be. If you think the experiences in your town are boring, that's your problem and your fault.
That was a great thought. You know what it said?
What's that?
If you're bored, then you're boring.
This is Eleanor Roosevelt said this. And she said, never be bored and you'll never be boring. And when my kids would tell me over summer vacation when they were little, I'm bored, I would tell them that. And they got to the point, they wouldn't tell me that. They would just go, well, you know, never be bored and you'll never be boring. You know, and they got to the, but they would find shit for themselves to do. They knew that it wasn't my responsibility, mm-hmm, to do it. And the reality is, this is the scary thing, Al. We're the ones we've been waiting for.
Brother, come on. Preach.
We are it. Nope, there's nobody around the corner going to do it for us. We got to do it for ourselves if we want it. If you don't want it bad enough to do it, you don't really want it.
Okay. So, like, Let's freshen the story up. We talked a little bit about the cover of music and just the local scene. Is just going back to your story. We're at high school, dude.
Yeah.
Like Duran Duran.
Okay, so high school is 86 to 90. And this is really when, like, the rubber hits the road with, like, the new wave bands and the college rock. And, like, I dive hardcore into, like, R.E.M., the Pixies.
And you're in Michigan?
I'm in Michigan, yeah. And at that point, like, by 87 and 88, I'm going to shows pretty regularly. At first, like, big stadium shows. And then, like, within a year or two, go into, like, smaller shows, like, driving the hour and a half to Detroit.
Let me ask you this. Is, yeah, like, big shows early with your parents or, like, big shows
with my
like
friends,
older friends,
my older friends drive, who could drive. Yeah, so I was,
yeah,
the first show I went to, I had just turned 16, and there's no way I would have even had a car, okay, that could get me. And so the first big show I went to with my friends was we all went to go see Sting on the Nothing Like the Sun tour.
Why not?
Yeah, and so that was, you know, that was amazing. And you know, once you have a couple of those experiences of those like big stadium shows, you're like, oh, I like this other band, but they're not playing a place like that big. But it's not like, oh, well, they can't play a place with 15,000 people, so they're not playing shows. It's, oh, no, you got to go to this place that's a deli during the day. And then in the back, they have shows at night. Or you got to go to this place, and they have this theater upstairs, but underneath, they got this 300-square-foot room where, you know,
mm-hmm,
15 people cram in. You know,
it's that a DIY scene.
Exactly. And so I went to go see DIY shows. I went to go see, you know, little underground new wave shows of touring bands. I went to go see lots of bands that played, you know, rooms that were like 800 to 1200 people. Like I saw a shit ton of shows like that.
Mm.
You know, those bands that were coming from England on their first or second record that weren't a big deal yet.
And during that own time in your like music life, I mean, like where were you at? How many, like, did you have any skin in the game?
Guitar, no, so piano? I didn't even start learning how to play guitar until I was 22. I started super late.
Okay.
I was 20.
Well,
I apologize.
Brother, I'll say this about you. It's late at night. I'm not even going to ask for you to play, but with your storytelling and your presentation for the song, it looks like you've been doing, I mean, granted, I know it's 20 years, but I mean, it's well polished,
man. Thank you very much, man. That means a lot.
Well polished.
You see a lot of shows, and to hear that from you means a lot. I really appreciate it.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of times to where, and to each their own, to whatever they want to do. And,
right, for sure.
I always like being to those small, intimate shows to where, like, maybe it is a 2-hour, maybe it's a 45-minute.
Right.
But, like, between songs, it's just interact a little bit, talk about the song a little bit, and I'm a huge fan of it, too. Like, if I get a singer-songwriter around, dude, if I was going to play a song of mine and I'm in a place that I've never been, I will. Like, let's just say there's a song called High Horse.
Okay.
And this happens to be, it's a friend of mine's song, Early James. And I've seen him play it live. And he'll say this is a song about horses and being high on them. It don't have a damn thing to do with that. But that is the name of the song.
Right.
And when you get to listen to it, it's actually a song about struggling with addiction and trying to overcome it and trying to figure out why you can't do it on your fucking own.
Right.
And then, like, when you go back to listen to that little bit that he shared before he played it, it's like, we're having a little fun here.
Yeah.
And it,
I want to touch on something you just said. You said addiction and why we can't beat it on our own. I think one of the things I've learned in the last year is that I don't know if there's much that's worthwhile that we really do on our own. I think most of the really beautiful and big, almost all of the really beautiful and big things we do in our lives require other people. Boy. We cannot do the important shit by ourselves, and we shouldn't expect to.
We're social beings, dude.
Not only that, but you know, that whole idea of it takes a village to raise a child works for everything. It takes a village to put on a festival. It takes a village to build a scene. It takes a village to create a restaurant. It takes a village to create a band.
Yeah, and I would say it also only takes one person to tear it down.
Sure. Yeah. If you got absolutely.
If you got the right shithead.
Yeah, if you got the right person, they can, you know, they. But usually, what's beautiful is, I think, the work of the people who are part of that village that endures. Usually the shithead doesn't endure. He flames out.
He does.
He flames out.
And he'll move on.
Yep. And he will remove himself from the experience before you have to.
I found that out too.
Yeah.
Dealings with him. So well, brother, let's fast forward a little bit. You're out of high school.
Yeah.
You're doing all these DIY shows, arena shows. We're stepping into 22. Why in the world would you begin to pick up an instrument? What was ticking in that brain,
man? I never wanted to be a shredder. I tell people all the time, the reason I picked up a guitar was because I wanted to see if I could play like Peter Buck from R.E.M.
Okay.
And Johnny Marr from The Smiths. And I wanted to write songs like Billy Bragg. And so I literally picked up a guitar to be a songwriter. My mom, you know, like I said, I grew up around that, and so that was a part of my life. I read a fair amount as a kid and was really interested in storytelling and in film, even at an early age. And it all just kind of made sense that I would use songs to tell stories. And I've been doing that for 30 years.
I can tell it. I'm so happy that you came to Columbus and shared some of your stories and your songs. And now to be doing this, I mean, also, I just think about if this is your first time passing through this part of the country, what stories could possibly come of these people that you meet?
One of the,
you know?
That's a great question, Al. I think one of the things I've been thinking about in my time, really in the sort of the deep south, you know, Florida, Alabama, Georgia. I know Florida's kind of its own thing, but I was in northern Florida.
Yeah.
And the thing that I've really been kind of fixated on is that everywhere I go, people are so excited to be in a room with other people and to connect. And I think, you know, we spent a little time earlier tonight talking about social media and sort of the ups and downs of it, right? I think one of the things that we have done is we have started to believe that connection is acknowledgement of information. I know a thing, I see a thing, that's a connection. I know from being on Facebook that Al had to work today and then went and got tacos on the way home.
Sure.
I know that. That does not connect me to you in any way whatsoever. It means I'm aware of what you did. Now, there's value in that, and maybe most of the time that's enough in a relationship. But there are times where you really genuinely need to connect, and I think sometimes we don't know how to do that digitally, and we don't make it a point to get in a room, and we struggle to do it now because we practice less. And so it gets harder, and so it's easier to put it off, and the cycle goes, and we are, as a rule, and I'm not just making this up, lonelier than we have ever been. We are more disconnected than we have ever been, even though we have all of this technology that supposedly brings us together.
Well, that's the gift of the internet, right? They thought that social media and like this internet experience, although it would tether the world together and that all these people from all over could communicate with one another, that it would bring us all closer, when in fact it drove us further and further apart. Because, you know, like, with the example that you gave, it's like, yeah, you know that I woke up this morning and I had tacos for lunch. And when I went home, I wasn't up to a whole lot. And then I just petered off and went to bed. But, like, when we get online to look at something like that, I believe, like, there's a little bit of malice and malintent in what we were doing, because, like, we were probably comparing ourselves to what someone else that we admire or try to compare ourselves to, or maybe like on the malicious side of it, an enemy or someone we don't like, and we're trying to make ourselves look like we're doing better than that.
And I think about, sure, I think about it from the standpoint of like people that we do like, and we compare ourselves to them, and we make what we see of their experience,
sure,
the version of them that we see, and then we compare ourselves to that. And the first thing we have to remember is everything that people put up online is what they want to project.
It's not the real
deal, right? It's not real life. Nobody says, oh, let me get on Instagram because I stubbed my toe at 2 o'clock in the morning while I was going to the bathroom. Yeah. Like, nobody's going to post that, but we're all going to do that.
What if we did, dude? Wouldn't that be wacky?
I can't tell if that would make the internet more endearing or more difficult to be a part of.
It's like one or two. It's like, this is, and yet, this is awfully wholesome
and yet for all of the awfulness that the internet can generate, without it, you and I wouldn't be sitting here in this room together in Starkville, Mississippi. And so I look at the adventure that I'm having, the genuine dream that I'm out here living. And the internet allows me to get in the car and to be in a room with these people. And that, to me, is the power of what's possible. But if we don't do the work, it's not going to come to us. You know, one of the things I've noticed is I'm out driving anywhere between, you know, 4 and 6 hours on average a day. I'm playing shows. I'm setting up. I'm tearing down. I'm hanging out with people. I'm doing podcasts. I'm drinking beer. We're having dinner. There's not a ton of time. I'm not on social media.
You're way better for it.
I feel real fucking happy right now.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, when I do check in, what I'm doing is I'm sharing photos from Munson and Brothers today.
Yeah.
And then people are going, oh, wow, that looks really cool. And so you can kind of put a little goodness out into the world, and then you sit back and go, oh, so-and-so commented, or so-and-so liked that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not constantly hunting for that endorphin because I have hours to kill, sure, or because I'm not doing anything, or because I'm working from home and it's easy to just open the other tab, which is what often happens to me. Yeah. Like, I'll get a little bored. I'll be writing a thing or working on a deal or like between projects or something. And I'll go, oh, I'll just peek at that. And then I'll look down and realize I just lost an hour. It's just gone.
How, before I go back on the timeline.
Yeah.
How much value do you put on your time?
More than I used to, but still not enough. It's interesting. One of the things I've been saying on tour is that in the last year, I've struggled for money in a way that I haven't for 15 years or so because I left a career. I left a big boy job.
Sure.
But I've never been wealthier than I am right now because I get to go out and do what I want every night, the way I want to do it, with the people that I want to do it with.
I love that.
And no amount of money buys you extra years on this rock.
Sure.
Ain't none of us getting out of the grand secret at the end. We're all going to face it.
Yeah.
And the sooner that you own up to that and realize what time you got left belongs to you, the happier you will be.
Well, I mean, I think that might take us back a little bit then.
All right.
When did you begin to figure that out? So take me back to you're out of college.
Yeah.
You're playing a little bit.
Yeah.
And up to, like, you got your big boy job.
Yeah, I got my big boy job. I was 28.
And you're working. Mm-hmm. You're playing little side gigs. And all of a sudden, you think you're a songwriter and you can step out. I mean, like,
well, the first one that I thought I could step out was in the early aughts. I was in a band called the Pantones, and we put out a record in 2005 called Sleepless Nights, Silent Mornings. And
we had sitting over there. Is that a record?
No. It's not one of those records, but there are some records over there. We'll talk about those in a minute. But anyway, this record, this CD kind of. You know, cracked a couple things open for us, and we were getting some reviews. We're getting some airplay around the country, even getting some airplay and selling some CDs in Europe. I was making a little bit of money. It wasn't like a lot of money. And all of a sudden, we were getting booked, and we didn't have to work at it. I had been busting my ass to book, and all of a sudden now, their offers are just coming in. We're like, we're not making big money, but people are emailing and saying, hey, do you want to come and play this? And we get invited to a couple festivals, and it really kind of felt like we were going to bust through. And the reality was, at the time, I was in my early 30s. I had this big boy job. I had two young kids. I wasn't going to go chase this dream because it wasn't practical. I was the sole breadwinner in my family. I wasn't going to leave my kids behind. And so I went, I'm not going to go for the brass ring right now. The timing is just really terrible. And I kind of thought that I had just closed the window on that. Like, I had just given up music as a profession. And that was okay. It was really okay because I knew that I could still, I mean, I was still playing 50 gigs a year. So I'm still doing it, but I wasn't gonna give up my day job, basically is what I'm saying. And then that band kind of petered out, and then a buddy of mine who had been in a honky tonk band called the Gentleman Callers in Lansing, who's a dear friend, calls me up one day and he says, Maddie, I just talked to our friend Jason Lancher from Calliope, who is an unbelievably talented guitar player. And Jason and I want to know if you want to be in a power pop band with us. And my answer was, where the fuck have you been for 15 years?
No.
And so we started the Stick Arounds. And at first, it was really kind of like a side project for Jeff's band and a side project for my band. And over the course of the next couple of years, it really kind of became our main thing. And I've been in that band now for 15 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Working it.
It's the life of that band is very, like, super active, and then we'll die down for a little bit, and then we'll get super active, and then we'll die. But that's the nature of guys who have disparate day jobs and different schedules. Like, we have one guy who's a teacher, another guy drives Uber and Lyft and plays in bands and kind of does what I do. Another guy works at the university. Another guy works at a natural foods and grocery store. And so we all kind of have our own schedules and have our own things, and so what we try to do is
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water. Enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to countrymd.com/energy. And order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's countrymd.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Carve out long weekends, and that's how we play shows. So we'll go carve out like a Wednesday to a Sunday or a Thursday to a Saturday or whatever, and we'll do 3, 4, 5 dates, and then we'll come back home.
That's one thing that always makes real good sense to me, and I think a lot of people that I play music with is, like, for the most part, we're all working day jobs.
And right.
Like, music is not, like, the breadwinner. But I'm thinking about my 9-to-5ers who met by the factory workers and, like, are really providing for the families. It's like, how do we make that applicable to them? Like, what does that mean to them?
I think what it has to mean is, what can you carve out that is sustainable, that feels nourishing? And I know that's a lot of...
Could that be time with the kids,
kind of,
dude?
You know, kind of vague words, but let me give you a couple of examples.
Yeah.
So I have a bunch of dear friends who play in this band who I'm going to try to get to come to Columbus after my experience tonight. They're called the Wild Honey Collective. And they're kind of a folk and bluegrass outfit. And it's kind of a core group of people. And then the other members kind of... Sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out, based on people's schedules.
Sure.
That's largely built around people's work and family schedules. But every year what they do is they plan a whole 10-day window where they go to Michigan's Upper Peninsula and they play breweries up there and they play this old historic theater and they play like 8 shows in 10 days and they all take their kids and their wives. And it's a family vacation for them.
Sounds like my blues band.
And that is the way that they build their vacation. It is the way that they have built their summer schedule. It's the way that their band operates. And it's important to them, and they've made it a priority. And I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's just one way of doing it. I think another way to do it is to say, I've got X amount of personal time, vacation time, sick time that I can take. And say, I'm willing to spend a percentage of that on days on the road. And just, you know, because some of it is, we want to say, oh, I don't have the time. Yeah, you do. You don't want to make the time. And I'm not saying you're not busy. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, eventually we'll make time for it or we won't. And if we eventually don't make time for it, then we've decided it's not that important. So if it's really important, you have to will it into being. It will not happen by accident.
Brother, like, carving that hour a day for me to spend time with my guitar, mm-hmm. and to like really tally-ho, sit down with a pen, whatever that looks like. Yeah, that is time I have to sometimes make myself do it.
Ernest Hemingway, you brought up Hemingway earlier. He's one of my favorites. Ernest Hemingway was once asked by a young journalist, "Mr. Hemingway, do you only write when you're inspired?" And he said, "Young man, that's absolutely true, but I get inspired every morning at 9 a.m. when I sit down to my desk."
Yep.
And the reality is...
And that is what gets me fired up. I write every day, Matt.
I love this. My dear, dear friend, Colonel, who's the drummer in the Stick Arounds and my other band, Harbor Coat, went through this thing at COVID where he taught himself how to play guitar. He was late 40s, didn't know how to play guitar. He messed around a little bit, taught himself how to play
guitar. Listen up.
Taught himself how to play guitar. And he sits down, and it turns out that Joel's a really good songwriter. And Colonel sits down, and for a while, he was writing a song every single day. And what he would do is he would just go, whatever it is, I'm going to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you something. As a guy who started a Substack 15 months ago and publishes nearly every day, not while I've been gone, but nearly every day, knowing that I do that consistently day in, day out, week in, week out, and I hit publish, every time I do that, I get a little bit better. Every time you finish a song as a songwriter, you get a little bit better. Every time you play it in front of a crowd, you get a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
My mom said something to me. She came out to see me. I had this big, lovely love fest of a kickoff show in Lansing before I started this tour. The first night of the tour was in my hometown. We sold out this little theater. And my mom said, "Matthew, you've never sounded better." And I was so touched tonight. And
from your own mother.
Yeah, and I was really, really pleased. But I turned to her and I said, "I hope so. If not, I might not be doing it right." Because the idea is we should always be improving. Now, I'm not always going to have... It's not always going to be the best night, right? But the point is that over time, that graph should go up. And we should... Our skill and our craft should improve in a way that is discernible. We should be able to look back at 5 years ago and go, I'm a better songwriter than I was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
If I don't make that progress, I'm not working hard enough.
Yeah. What, is there a stick? Is there a gauge, man? Is there a time length? Like, what goes on around, like, let's say this tour wraps up.
Yeah.
And you're just back at home, just family man.
Yeah.
You're cooking. You got some ideas boiling up. Like, what does that day-to-day look like?
So, I'm an early riser. I like to work first thing in the morning.
You drink a little coffee.
I like to get up, make myself a pot of coffee. And I mean early. Like, I might get up at 5, sometimes even earlier if I can't sleep. And yeah. I'll just, you know, if I get up at 3 and I, you know, go to the bathroom and I come back and I go to sleep for a little bit and I wake up again at 4 and I can't go to sleep, by 4:30 I'm probably just going to get up and put a pair of jeans on and go do some shit. So I'm going to get up and I'm going to write. I'm going to work on my blog. Usually what I do is I write for a little while to kind of clear my mind. And then I play guitar. So after I've written for an hour or two, I play guitar for 10, 15 minutes and kind of see if anything
comes up,
bubbles up. Because I've been working and I've kind of lubed up the machine, if you will. And I think what I need to do is turn that 10 minutes into a half an hour. And I think if I could do that in a way where I could make it a pattern, I think I could get to the point where I was writing something worth looking at every day. But I also know that one of the things that I've really gotten more confident about is I've always felt pretty confident about my singing and my songwriting, but I've always been a little bashful about my guitar playing. And, you know, like I do really great with cowboy chords and I can do some other stuff and I can arpeggiate pretty well, actually. But the point is I've never felt confident. I've never felt like, oh, people should come see me because I'm a guitar player. Like that, I happen to be a guitar player. You should come see me because I do this other stuff.
You're a songwriter.
Right. I'm a songwriter. I'm a storyteller. I'm a singer. I play guitar because that's the medium that I've chosen. And in feeling more confident about those other things makes me worry less about whether or not I'm a great guitar player. And I think it's, again, about going back and sort of having those moments where I have to go, what do I want to prioritize and fixate upon? And I do want to play guitar a little bit to be a better guitar player. And so some of that practice just makes me a better guitar player. So I get better at that, but it also opens up the portal to writing. And so I'm hoping that by doing that every day...
What do you do to keep it fresh on the guitar?
Play other people's songs sometimes. Sometimes I'll learn songs. One of the things that I never used to do that I do a lot now is I play along with records.
That's interesting. One thing that I've been having to do is change tune.
This is another great way to change perspective. When I first started really writing songs for myself, because I played around a lot with
that. There's only so many places where a capo can go.
Right.
And yeah. I don't want to sound like everybody else.
No, and but I think about it like, okay, to me the simplest way to prove that we haven't run out of ways to use that is go listen to those Hank Williams records.
Okay, yes.
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay.
I appreciate you saying that.
DAG. That's the entire Hank Williams canon is basically in DA and G. There's some G's and C's thrown in there and shit, but largely, if you know those three chords, you
might
can
have an E minor.
Maybe. But like, we are talking about a lot of like real simple cowboy chords.
Yeah,
it is all about the way he uses melody and lyric and phrasing. And if you can play within that, you can do a whole lot of shit that people have done before.
Do you think that's why you give more emphasis to your writing than to your guitar playing?
Absolutely. Yeah, because I essentially am writing. I'm a storyteller. I'm essentially telling stories.
So it's not so much about the music. It's more about the words.
For me, it's about the melody. And that's the cloud on which everything else rides.
How'd you get there? Because for me, it was nursery rhymes. And I knew, like, let's go back to Nirvana just for a second.
Okay.
Because they would write the most ridiculous words. But it was in a nursery rhyme style to where sure. It was very memorable.
Right.
Even though it didn't make any sense.
Right.
And so then when you take that to a crafting a song and a story, it gives you a beat.
I think to answer your question, I think if we're looking for like a nexus point of where I found that, I think it's probably the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Hell yeah, dude.
I mean, I became pretty obsessed with hooks and choruses and how a song got more exciting at a certain part. Like even as a kid, like I was like, I wanted to know how that worked. I wanted to know what the insides were. Like I was fascinated
by
everything.
Is it ever more than a key change?
Well, no, I just mean like the way a chorus lifts, you know, the way it goes from like a little thing, and then all of a sudden you make the chord change and you go from the G to the D, and so there's, you know, you're hitting the relative, and it's, you know, it's pushing forward and it sounds really good and it's fun. But you know, you might add another instrument and the Ringo might change what he's doing or how he's playing, and so that's changing the texture underneath.
Sure.
And Paul changes his bass part and George has a sweet little guitar riff, and it was like, that was the first time I understood how records were produced, was when I listened to those two bands. I understood that what you were creating were these little moments where, you know, Wouldn't It Be Nice doesn't sound like a regular pop song. You know?
No, it really doesn't.
You know, it's built in a way that's more like a movie. And I was really fascinated by these really hummable movies, and that's what I wanted to make. I wanted to make short. I had a reviewer one time say that I wrote short stories with chords, and it was one of the nicest compliments I've ever got.
I was about to give you a compliment about like the music that you provided tonight, and I think it was well accompanied by the stories told.
Oh, thanks.
With what you did, it did have a movie element, and also like the first song, and I forget the name. That you played outside for us.
Yeah.
You did a run. Between each verse and coming out of a chorus.
Yeah.
And, like, that did a really good job of like honing things back in. And I don't know if that was the original intent, but like verse, chorus, and having that little run kind of like helped tie things all together.
That's awesome.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Thanks for noticing. I have always loved passing chords.
Sure. That's what they were. Like it might have been that.
And so for me, it... like
G, F sharp.
That's literally what it is. There's a G, there's an F sharp, there's an E minor, there's like an A and a B in there. Like it just kind of does that little, you know, it's like the bottom two strings or whatever. But anyway, the thing that's really fun for me about like stuff like writing stuff like that is sort of, gets back to the evolution thing, that idea of instead of just adding a passing chord, I'll do a little arpeggiated run. And it'll just be a little simple thing that feels more complicated than it actually is and kind of resets the palette a little bit. So it's that kind of stuff that's really... and some of that, too, was, you know, input from my bandmates. You know, that was a song where, like, we kind of built it and demoed it in the studio and kind of crafted it that way. And so we, you know, we play it live now, but we built it and recorded it before we ever played it live.
Yeah, that makes sense, dude. Kind of like try to incorporate a little bit of like just some elements that you can bring. You're only one man and one instrument. You can only bring, but a good thing to bring.
Yeah, man.
Because I wouldn't say so much of a bookmark, but it does kind of like here's one end and here's... Does that make sense?
It feels to me, even though it's not a bridge, it feels like a bridge between the parts. It feels like a way to kind of separate them, but also connect them together. Like you can see that one section is different than the other, but this is a sort of a synapse between the two that kind of fires.
Yeah. Just for those, listen, here you are. You're in Columbus, Mississippi, playing at Munson Brothers. Now we're in Starkville having a conversation. You've been to Florida. You've been to Alabama. Now you're in Mississippi.
Yeah.
What has really stood out about this experience so far with the tour?
So this is my first time in this part of the country, really. I've been in Florida a number of times, but I'd never been to Mississippi or Alabama before this week. And I've been really excited about it because I always love seeing new places, and I love seeing places that are different than where I'm from. Mm-hmm. And I made this joke tonight that some stereotypes exist for a reason.
Sure.
And in this case, the stereotype of Southern hospitality exists for a reason because it's a real goddamn thing. It's true, you mm-hmm. know. One of the things that's beautiful about doing this is there's not a single place I've been where people aren't excited to show off their home. Even if they know the flaws of it, they still want to show you what's great about it. And they still want to share it with you. And they want to share the best of themselves and the best of their town with you. And that's, there's something really humbling and beautiful about that when people want to share what's really important to them and give that to you for a night. And so for me, it's being grateful for that opportunity and showing up every night and not inserting my own expectations into it, but treating it as an experience and saying, What am I going to offer to this, and what is it going to offer me? How is this a symbiotic relationship? You know, and what's been really gratifying and rewarding is no matter how small the crowd, no matter how odd the environment, I've always been able to find a handful of folks that really are tuned in and honed in. And it's a beautiful thing. As I said to you tonight, you know, you get a handful of people there who want to have a genuine experience and who are truly engaged in the songs and the stories that I'm sharing. What more as a performer can I ask of an audience? What more can I expect when I show up in a town than to say, hey, we're going to have, I don't know, 10 people or whatever that are going to be here to really pay attention to your songs. To me, that's worth driving for.
Right on. Three questions to walk out of the door.
Right.
Question one, if people want to hop along the adventure with Matthew Carlson.
Yeah.
website, social medias, where would be the best place? Email? Or where would
I think the best place that people should go is they should sign up for a free subscription at my Substack, which is whatamimaking.substack.com. Substack is a newsletter and blog and podcast platform. And you can sign up for free. And then if you dig it later on, you can sign up for a paid subscription. It's totally up to you. But the idea is...
Is it interactive?
It's totally interactive. And there's a great social portion of it that is kind of pretty genuine and still pretty great. Nobody's ruined it yet. There's a wonderful community of music writers over there that's really, really good. I've gotten to know a lot of people.
That's what I was really asking about. Because like Substack's where you like... daily thoughts and like
So what I do is
fleshing out ideas.
So what I the way I use it is I have a podcast that comes out every Monday. I have a radio show that I do.
Oh, plug the podcast, dude.
Yeah, it's whatamimaking.substack.com.
The podcast
is called What Am I Making, and you can get it wherever you get your pods. And I talk to musicians, artists, writers, filmmakers, travelers, photographers. And
we're the same vein, bro.
Yeah, and we're essentially having conversations about why do you do what you do and what motivates you and what kind of life are you really building with your creativity. Like, it's not just about the thing you're making or the thing you did or the thing you liked. It's what is that doing for your world and why are you... Like, if you and I were going to have a conversation, and we're going to have a conversation, I'm going to want to know... Why are you spending your time and money trying to build a scene? And don't answer because we'll talk about it. But I'm not asking you that because I want to know about what you're doing. I want to know about why you're doing what you're doing. Okay. And I think, to be honest with you, the magic of most of the shit that's wrong with us lies in the simple asking of that question. Because if we think about why we're doing what we're doing, it means we're thinking about what we're doing.
Well, I think it's the shadow of ourselves.
What do you mean?
I believe it goes to Carl Jung. It's a bit of philosophy.
Yeah.
But like there is a part of ourselves that we give to the shadow, which is the actual self. And then we project and we show the parts of ourselves that we think that our community... And maybe even outside of our community would like. And the things that I create and like what actually comes out of that is from the shadow, the things that I kind of keep off to the side.
Keep hidden.
Keep hid.
I think it's beautiful. I made a little discovery within the last year, and I shared it with a dear friend of mine a few months ago, and I said, you know, no one's ever broken my heart by being genuine with me.
How about that?
Nobody's ever removed themselves from my life because they were genuine and I couldn't handle it.
How about them apples, right?
And so I think the lesson is be genuine. Because it's not as terrifying as everyone thinks it is. And it's not as costly as you might think it is.
Well, I think it might be the tragedy of, like, one of my favorite sitcoms of all time and comedian. Like, it might be the Seinfeld complex.
Yeah.
Like, it was always clean comedy. It was always a good show. And then, like, Kramer had his release at the comedy club and... And I mean, we could go through the whole history of the whole thing, but like one thing, and Jerry just came out with this Unfrosted on Netflix movie about cereal and Pop-Tarts, and I think that might be the greatest failure of many artists, and a thing that I have to fight daily is like. The shadow, if you will, to put it like Carl Jung, it's like you want to keep yourself in the shadow while bringing out all the things that you would like
for people.
Oh, no, no, no. I think it's even more insidious than that. I think the things that you show are what you think other people are going to like.
Okay, yeah, sure.
And I think when you put that stuff up because other people are going to like it, that's the moment at which you cease to be genuine. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying being genuine is easy, but it should be the goal. It should be the goal. A lot of it's been co-opted and misunderstood. I tend to find a lot of solace when I think about Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and the whole idea of mindfulness and intentionality and what are we really doing with our lives? What are we really... We talked earlier about how you get one go around at this. My dad used to say, this is not a dress rehearsal.
Hey.
It's a profound thing. We get to do this one time.
Yeah.
And the real question is, and no one else can answer this, what are you going to do with it?
I think most of us are kind of putting it off, aren't we?
We're waiting for, again.
We're waiting
for somebody else to do it for us, and no one's going to come do it.
Yeah.
And the sooner you wake up to that reality, the happier you will be.
Okay. Yeah, dude. Right on. Last question.
All right.
What was your favorite part of this interview?
I think the bit we just discussed. I think the idea of what we keep to ourselves and what we're afraid to show to the world, and that if we, I'm really, this is a recent discovery for me. I'm really obsessed with this idea. I truly believe,
brother. I appreciate you like giving me the space to where I felt comfortable enough to tell you what I really fucking thought, dude.
I appreciate that.
You hear me?
Yeah, of course I do. Absolutely, man. I believe that the world, gets saved the more people do beautiful things together. I think that's why we're here. I think that's the only way to prove that we were alive,
right,
is to make something beautiful. And maybe it lasts and maybe it doesn't, but we made it while we were here. The earlier in my tour, twice I got to stand at the edge of the Atlantic Ocean, like out on these rock formations, once in Maine and once in Rhode Island. And you feel so tiny and so small and so insignificant.
Sure.
And at the same time, you feel so connected. You mentioned earlier, it's like what you said, it's like water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were all drawn to it. There's also something about standing there and realizing that everything is interconnected and that we are all spinning on this rock together, and we are all, for lack of a better explanation, in the same boat. And it's really a matter of figuring out, I'm going to mix my metaphors here a little bit, but, you know, maybe we're not all in the same boat, but we're all in the same fleet. And it's figuring out, how much do I want to follow the caravan and how much do I want to row for myself? And figuring out, I need to keep these people with me because it takes a village, like we talked about. But I also have to find my own, I have to chart my own way and chart my own path. And I have to be able to find a balance between those two things. And that's really, it's hard. But until you start thinking about why you're doing what you're doing and what motivates you, I don't think you have a chance of getting to the truth.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you this, is I have a great amount of respect for you because you're just outside of Lansing, Mississippi, Michigan?
Yeah.
You're here in Mississippi?
Yeah.
You've been touring for how long?
3 weeks.
3 weeks?
Yeah.
So, I mean, living proof. And, like, I'm thankful for you coming on the show. And it also, I hope, like, people who are listening who wants to get out on the road, like, maybe, you know, because it's so hard and your situation is so different. Every situation is so different financially
And you've got to figure out what are you willing to sacrifice to do this? Because that's what it comes down to. You've either got to give up your time or some money or both. And so what are you not going to buy? What are you not going to have? What, you know, are you going to put off a car for another year so you can do this? Are you going to not move into a nicer house? Mm-hmm. Are you not going to get that pool? Are you, you know, going to stop buying lunch out for a year so you can save
are
enough
you cool
money for
going you know? Back on the ramen noodle diet?
You know, yeah. I mean, it's really a matter of what are you willing to do to put it in place? You said skin in the game. Are you going to put some skin in the game? Are you going to sacrifice something? Because you don't get to go, I want my life to go on the way it is, and then I want this other thing, and I should get it for nothing. Like, that's just not how the world works. Now, sometimes we get that shit handed to us, and that's just called luck. And that's a good thing, and we should accept it as luck and feel...
But don't think it's going to happen to you.
Exactly. And don't think it's a regular occurrence, even if it does. But for me, I think it's that idea of knowing that, like... I mean, when I got to Gulf Shores yesterday, I was exhausted. Like, I was fucking tired. It was 1:30.
You were having a good time, wasn't you, buddy?
I had a great time. But the point is, I was exhausted when I got there, and I needed to, like, refresh, and I needed an hour and a half, and I had a beer, and then I felt better, and I did my thing. But I felt that way because I love what I do. If I had showed up that way exhausted at a job for somebody else, I would have half-assed it all day long. But I wasn't working for somebody else. I was working for me. Work for yourself. Maybe you can't tour. I'll bet there's a brewery in your town. And I'll bet you they'll let you set up at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon and let you play for tips.
There you go.
And you know what? If you do it, and you do it, and you do it, and you do it, you're going to get better.
You will get a lot better.
You're going to get better. And I also believe this. I also believe that every once in a while we should do something that scares the shit out of us. And this is the thing that scares the shit out of most people. Even the people who want to do it, they get up there and they go, oh, this is terrifying.
Got skin to do it.
Oh, this is, I got a buddy. He's played with me in bands for 20 years. Genius musician. Can play anything. Has a photographic memory. The dude is ridiculous.
You got a skin to do it.
He's ridiculous.
You got to get into something you ain't never done.
Yeah, yeah. So he just started his own band. And he just played his first
he's
show.
He's skinny dipping, dude.
Right? Yeah. And he did a little preview thing at a little house show we did like a month ago, before he played my opening show in Lansing on June 5th, and so a couple weeks before that we get together at this farm, you know, about a half hour from our house. And he was like a deer in the headlights, man. He was not prepared, and he stopped a couple times, and I was like, you know, and it was like it was all like. Very safe space, like, you know, 30 people.
He was eating shit, but he really wasn't.
No. But it was a great place for him to kind of fall,
sure,
to fall off the bike, so to speak. But you could even see that after he'd put a bunch of work in over the next 2 weeks to get ready for that show, you could see the sort of terror. That's good for David. David's never put himself in that situation. That will push him to be a different player and to have a gratitude about being on that stage that he may not have had before. And I think humbling experiences like that are really good for us. And there's nothing so humbling as standing up in front of a group of people and playing shit that's really important to you. Saying, pay attention to me. This is my life's work. And then people sit there and have a conversation about Desperate Housewives or Grey's Anatomy or
whatever
the fuck's going on Game of Thrones. You know? The point is, it's a courageous act to make art. Don't think you're not doing something brave. But again, don't think that it's going to come without an effort or sacrifice or that it's going to be easy when it does.
Fair enough. Maddie C., Matthew Carlson, go see him when you can. All the links will be in the show description. We'll see you later.
That was fun, dude.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients.
Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.